Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream on the 18th of October 2022. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on this Tuesday evening. And going to have a great chat with Chris in just a second. Before I bring him in, let me just remind you, as always, that we don't provide specific financial, legal or indeed property advice. It's a general conversation. The chat room is moderated. But I do encourage you to share your views and opinions on the chat and chat with each other. This is as at the 18th of October if you're watching in replay, and use at Walk the World if you'd like to get my attention. That makes sure I see your question in the queue. I've also enabled Super Chat, which enables you to get your question to the top of the list and also to make a contribution to cover the costs of what we do here if you'd like to do that. Always greatly appreciated. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to bring Chris in. Chris. Whoops. Are you there? Hello.
Martin, how are you? Good to see you.
Very good.
How's everyone doing, watching on from home or wherever?
Yes, all wherever they are. Virtually, we've got people overseas in various places as well as on the Australian mainland as well.
Hopefully not, they don't fall asleep like the dogs, but that's okay.
Has been known, but hopefully not. Anyway, great to have you back on, Chris. And look, there's a lot going on, a lot we're going to talk about tonight. But before we get into the detail, two things. We should actually just say you were, of course, the celebrated Chris Bache because you won an award, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we got top broker at Connective, which is just last week, which is awesome. That's sort of based on settlement numbers. And there's like 3,500 plus brokers at Connective. And yeah, we were top in New South Wales, and New South Wales is pretty much one of the biggest states. So, yeah, it's a great achievement by the team. We had a massive year last year. So, yeah, thanks for sharing that, Martin.
Well, congratulations. Well deserved. And it's quite prestigious. And in fact, I'm sort of involved on the other side because I'm one of the many judges that they use as part of the program. I didn't see your name
coming
in the bit that I was looking at because there were lots of different categories. But I'm one of the judges. So there you go.
Good. Hopefully, give me a favour next time.
Anyway, look, just for those people who may not know you, why don't you just give yourself a quick introduction? You know, what you do and those sort of things. That'd be quite a useful start of the conversation.
Okay. Yep. So I started as a financial planner back in 2007. And for the first 5 years, it was, you know, working with a lot of older clients, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, typical financial planner work, right? Helping people sort of retire. And once they have retired, trying to help their money last. Back in 2012, I stopped working with older clients and shifted to working with younger clients, you know, younger couples and younger families. And the conversation really shifted from, you know, how do we retire, but how do we grow our money? A bit more of the accumulation space. But the company I joined really guided people on their property decisions. And it was more luck than skill. I just joined a company which had great property ethics and, you know, didn't partner with, you know, developers or selling off the plan or spruikers, et cetera, and really sort of guided people on proper strategy around mortgages and property decisions and how to do this and that. And we sort of stayed there for a few years, started my own business 8 years ago. We're doing financial advice and mortgages. We ended up selling the financial advice business. And as you can see with what Martin was just showing there, we've sort of grown to one of the biggest brokerages out there. Our clientele is really that, you know, higher income, you know, double income, young family, you know, typically our average loan size per client's around 1.5 million. And so, you know, you've got to sort of understand that we're coming from a certain point of view. It's not the whole mass market, but we do see lots of clients. We spoke to over 1,000 clients last year and not all worked with us, but, you know, 1,000 different people thinking about property. So, hopefully you can get some value out of this chat. I mean, our focus is really just guiding people on their decision, helping them think it through. You know, do we buy? Do we sell? Should we sell that property? What's, you know, do we renovate? Well, as you can see in the background, I'm doing one myself. And then we make it happen from a bank point of view, like a typical broker, but it's very advice driven. It's very much focusing on also educating on what's a good property. I've got a podcast with Veronica Morgan, which you may or may not know about, Elephant in the Room. I mean, that's going for over 4 years now, 250 episodes on that. So that's something else you might want to digest. We partner with buyer's agents, not just Veronica. Veronica, we work a lot with the Inner West in Sydney, but we work with other buyer's agents in the Inner West, and we refer to all individual buyer's agents all over the country in individual pockets where they're the expert in that market, like a real estate agent, but a buyer's agent that just been buying in that market, usually for at least 5 years. And so we don't actually do the property, you know, selection.
Yeah, and I think the education piece, you know, hats off to you and to Veronica and your other colleagues, because I think this is really, really important. And I keep coming back to the same thing again, Chris, that, you know, there are so many things that people need to think about if they're getting into the property buying game. And it's not just about, you know, just the transaction. There's a whole bunch of upstream pipeline thinking about it, as well as preparing appropriately for finding the right property in the right place at the right price. You know, there's a bunch of stuff, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, we start thinking about it and you might think, okay, yeah, I need to, you know, think about this. And then it all of a sudden opens up a can of worms. And the deeper you go, the more you realize you don't know, to be honest. And the more I keep learning, and that's one of the reasons why I love the podcast. It just keeps on saying, oh, maybe have you thought about that? Have you thought about how that would change this? I mean, the property market is completely unregulated. That's the first thing anyone entering it needs to understand. You know, real estate agents, buyers agents, no one's really watching what anyone says or does. And unfortunately, that encourages people to come in and make some money there. And so it's full of spruikers and, you know, the commissions on offer to sell certain types of property, like new property and, you know, house and land packages and apartments, et cetera, are huge. And there's so many companies out there that will, you know, sell you the dream and promise all these tax benefits, but then sell you a dud property where they make big commissions. And it's very hard to get independent, true independent property advice. Even buyer's agents struggle with this, because you walk in there and you say, I've got a budget of X. They're going to say, well, I can buy you a good property in my little patch for that price. Or why don't I go buy you an investment property in a state that I don't even know anything about, but you know, at least I get you as a client. And so it's very hard in the property game to figure out who to trust, because everyone's incentivized to sell something. Even broking, you know, you think you go into a broker and you know, not many brokers will stop you and say, really, should you save more? Should you potentially, is that really the right type of property? Have you thought about what you're going to do when you have kids, et cetera? A lot of brokers see them as facilitators of transactions, and they don't want to put, you know, speed bumps in the way to slow you down, which may or may not mean you come on as a client. Whereas, you know, not in an arrogant way I'm saying this, but we do it every day. You know, we'll say, look, you know, really think you should get clarity around work, or are you going to have kids, or, you know, what, maybe you should sell that property before you buy another property, just to make sure our clients are making good long-term decisions and thinking through their longer-term lifestyle. I think that's where a lot of people in property go wrong. They think, well, I'm just going to buy what I like or what's going to suit me today. And then all of a sudden life changes. Maybe they have a partner or they get kids, or and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, maybe that property decision didn't really set us up as the right stepping stone. And the problem with property, it's a huge transaction costs to buy and buy out. You also at the risk of market timing, you know, when you buy and sell could massively flip, you know, 2020 or 2021 to 2022. And we can go back many years, or you can get really lucky. You could buy in 2019 and sell in 2021. So yeah, the leverage effect is massive as well. Like the opportunity cost of making one good decision versus a bad one is massive. But also the rewards are there if you do get it right with leverage, you know, and that's yeah, something some people misunderstand.
Absolutely. And, you know, the point about having the long-term view rather than the short-term view, because it really, you know, the costs involved of acquiring a property means you've got to be thinking about how you amortize those costs over a reasonably long period of time. It isn't just a sort of a few months, is it?
Yeah, I've kind of looked at every. So we, so since 2012, you know, speaking to people every week, and I'm always just curious in the mind. I'll just say, okay, when did you buy that property? What did you pay for it? You know, what's it worth now, et cetera. And if you do that to thousands of people, and that's not an exaggeration, you start to learn what works and what doesn't work. And absolutely, the quantity sort of hot spotting strategy is more luck than skill. And, you know, a lot of people, they'll get one right, they'll get one wrong, and then, you know, the returns will be netted off, et cetera. So I've very rarely seen the quantity strategy work. And, you know, back in 2014, you could build a massive portfolio because you could probably leverage 12 times your income, but you can't do that, you know, since, you know, maybe 2017, 2018, when it all really, maybe it's 6 or 7 times income now. So you've only got limited capacity. And, you know, we're not really think many people can make money in flipping. You know, you've got to look at the current market. You know, a lot of people trying to make money in flipping would have been burnt dramatically. Maybe not even able to do the reno, and then they're, you know, ugly duckling, still an ugly duckling, and trying to sell it right now, you get absolutely burnt. So, yeah, we're not really a massive fan of flipping. We're just fan of buying absolute quality, you know, properties that will hold value over the longer term, because they're truly scarce and they suit a real market that is really the aspirational higher income family market, where there's a real problem, and they really want security and stability and live in an area that's, you know, inspires them. So Yeah, we're absolutely buy and hold. The other there's massive benefits for that. You don't pay capital gains tax to yourself, and you can redraw your gains to do in other investing, whether it's shares or property or renos, etc. Rather than sort of trying to flip property, paying lots of costs to do that, plus pay capital gains tax, then you got to get back in the market, and then you got the risk of trying to buy again, and maybe don't buy something as good as what you had. And yeah, it's a lot of effort when potentially if you just bought a quality asset and held it, you would have just just sat on your hands and switched off the news, you probably would have done just as well as the person trying to actively trade property.
Yeah, good point. That's probably true across some other asset classes too, like stocks and shares.
Absolutely.
Right? It's similar problem. Now, here's a question which came a little while ago. Are banks still lending on less than a 20% deposit from Leo? What's the story with underwriting at the moment, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, you've always pretty much could borrow it with a 10% deposit. Like, banks will always give you a 90% loan, more than a 90% loan, so less than a 10% deposit. It can, if you're a doctor, for example, you can even get 100% loan with no deposit, or 95 is really easy. But for the average punter in the street, trying to borrow with less than a 10% deposit, the number of banks that will offer you that is very few. You need to have a squeaky clean credit file. Probably the big negative for those people is they pay a massive lender's mortgage insurance. We just don't do loans over 90% because by the time you get to a 92 or 93% home loan or 7 or 8% deposit, the mortgage insurance is just astronomical. That you would have been better just to try to get another 2 or 3%. We're just not brokers who play in that space. I mean, Martin, you asked me all your questions before tonight. Think about hardship. We haven't got a single loan in arrears, and we haven't in 8 years. It's just that we just don't play in loans where we think our clients are going to get into problems. And that is an area where you could easily see negative equity. You can easily see people stretching because if they haven't got the ability to save for that 10% deposit, it's showing a sign that they're just trying to force something and they're not willing to do the hard yards to get to that 10%. So banks are pretty much always lending at 90%. I mean, they did stop some issues around investors at 90%, but a lot of investors use equity in their current home to borrow up to 80% and then borrow 80% on the investor. So that didn't really slow the investor market down. The magic number is really a 12% deposit, really, if you can. I mean, that extra 2% makes a big reduction to your mortgage insurance. And so that's the sweet spot that we're always trying to get our clients to. There is a bit of a myth, though, that you need a 20% deposit plus 5% for stamp duty, which is, say, 25% versus what we think 17%, 12% plus 5%. That extra 8% could take, on a $1 million property is $80,000. It could take you many years to save that. And by the time you save that extra 80 grand, that the market could have moved a lot more than what that mortgage insurance was. And so it's sometimes worthwhile paying mortgage insurance, even if you haven't got a 20% deposit.
Exactly. And again, it's important to do the maths. The other question and this came up beforehand actually from somebody who sent a question in, typical duration of a loan, used to be 25 years, often 30 years, sometimes 35 years in places now. What's your thoughts there,
Pretty much always 30 years, unless you're getting closer to retirement. Mm. And trying to get more than 30 is really difficult. Not every lender will do that. They're going less. Every lender will probably do 30 within reason, depending on your age. But going less than, 30, it's a personal choice. You could absolutely, set it up whatever you like. But all you're doing is putting more obligation on yourself to pay the mortgage down faster. Now, if you're someone who needs that obligation, if you need that forced savings on you, and you think that you can't be trusted to leave that money in redraw or in an offset account, then absolutely do a smaller loan term, force on yourself. But all you're doing is opening yourself up to risk if you need a buffer or if something goes wrong or you've lost your job and you've committed to higher repayments and you can't refinance because you've lost your job. So you've stuck on this, paying a property over 15 years because you wanted to force yourself, then you had no buffer because that's why you had to force yourself, et cetera. So, I mean, really best practice, if you can, is once you've learned the art of saving and spending less than you and you can save the money and get a deposit, then absolutely you probably go 30 years and try to use an offset account. That's absolutely best practice as long as you don't get sticky fingers and spend it. That's sort of the best structure.
So just to be clear, what you do is you say, 30 years, right? But what you do is you pay back what you need to pay back to the bank, but you try and put a little bit more and you put that into the offset account to reduce the interest that you actually get charged, which gives you flexibility so that effectively, you build up that buffer over time. I mean, that seems to be quite a smart way of doing it rather than giving yourself a more compressed 15 or 20 years to pay it off, which means you're just paying a lot more, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, ideally, you still want to try to pay it off in 15, 20 years, but you don't. You do it under your terms, not the bank's terms. And, I mean, I think the first thing people need to do is disconnect from their high salary, right? So, I'm getting whatever it is, right? So, let's say it's 10. And these, sometimes people on this channel get upset when I talk these numbers, but let's say it's $10,000 a month is your salary, right? Or combined for your family, right? Mm. You know, if you think you're earning $10,000 a month and you spend like you're earning $10,000 a month, that money's going to go fast. You know, if you go spend $200 or $300 on something, it's fine, I've got $10,000. What you really need to do is, how much have you really got left over once you take away all the mortgage, firstly? So you commit to an amount that's going to pay it off faster. So let's say the bank's minimum repayment is 3. You say, I really want to pay 5, right? And so if now I've got 5. So as soon as that 10 grand, you could even do this from your employer if you wanted to get technical, is you pay that into your mortgage offset account. Now, for me, best practice is you have your mortgage offset account at a different bank to where you do your day-to-day banking. Because as soon as it's in your day-to-day banking, you can get access to your offset account whenever you want to top up to spend some money, right? But if you do it at a bank where you're not seeing it and your day-to-day is, then you've got to go log into that internet banking. You could even lose the internet banking details if you wanted to force yourself. And then you've got to transfer it to your other bank. It's just putting, you know, this is all about behavioral finance. Instantly you think, well, I'm not earning 10 grand a month. I'm only earning 5 grand a month. But that's just the first step. The next step is saying, well, what's our fixed costs? Right? So what are the things we cannot change and do not want to change in our life? Well, that's 3.5 grand. Bang. So day one, that 10 grand comes in. 3.5 goes to a fixed bank account where you pay your fixed cost. Now you're only earning 1,500 a month. That's how much you're really earning. So when you make discretionary spending and you spend $200 on something, well, you're spending, you know, what's that, 14% of your monthly salary on that. Is it really that important? And I think that's where people get a lot of issues. So the benefit of that is, let's say in this situation, your 5 grand's gone to your mortgage offset, but 3's the minimum repayment. Well, 2 grand will accrue in your offset account. And in the next, you know, over the next first year, you'll have like 25 grand roughly in there. And, you know, that's paying off your mortgage because it's fully offset and your interest rate as well.
Absolutely. And it's so important to think this out, right? And there's always some, you know, things that you have to think through. Now, Cookie Boy asked this question a little earlier. If rates stay around 5%, I assume he means the cash rate, does property, is it still a good investment for the short to medium term, considering prices went crazy on cheap credit previously? So the change in interest rates, has it changed the formulation? What do you think?
Look, interest rates do drive behavior, right? And the higher interest rates are, the less likely people are going to want to stretch and take on debt, right? So that's absolutely what's driving into the market. I mean, I don't really like to, you know, think a whole asset class is not worthwhile because the interest rate is high, right? But absolutely, you know, you would want to be picking in certain markets and in areas where you're seeing significant wage rises and areas where people are willing to buy lifestyle and can afford higher interest rates. So if you think about this, in areas where people are struggling for income growth and there's not much money left over and they're taking out big mortgages with, you know, small deposits and they've got to pay 5%, absolutely, you probably wouldn't make sense, right? So it's about the markets where you're seeing income growth that can sustain higher interest rates and where people who are earning those higher incomes and that's, you know, they're wanting to buy into. So, I mean, probably survived 5% interest rates before. Yeah, it's gone up and it's, you know, but I don't think the 5% interest rate is going to kill the property market, put it that way.
Yeah, but there is a bit of a correlation with higher interest rates. Prices tend not to go up, maybe even come back a bit more, right? Particularly with the over-leveraged situation that some people have. But again, you've got to look at individuals because not everybody's in the same boat, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we were seeing some massive increases in salaries for our clients. You know, there's a talent shortage and, you know, you're getting headhunted and you're basically saying, look, you know, if you come join us. A lot of people didn't want to move. Like, worker mobility dropped with COVID, right? Why would you swap jobs when there's a pandemic and I'm not sure how flexible work's going to go and I just don't want to put that stress on my family right now. And, yeah, I've got it pretty good working at home. So, but as we're coming out of it, you know, people are switching jobs. So, I think you'll see that's when people mainly get the wage increase, right? You don't get it asking your boss for more money, but you get it when you swap jobs. And I think that's something that's really going to start flowing through.
Absolutely. Well, let me just put this one up from Cookie because he said, are banks getting more strict with loans? And that takes us quite nicely into the underwriting question, right? How have they changed, or have they not changed, from where we were before rates started to rise? Are they asking more questions, different questions? Is it easier or harder than it was? What do you think?
Banks are risk on. So banks aren't saying here, we don't want to lend money. Absolutely. Credit flow has dropped off dramatically over the last few years because of lower transactions. Lots of people are trading right now because it's not a great time. And, you know, refinance boom over the last few years. All the banks are very scared because their loan books aren't growing enough to sort of sustain big bank profits, right? And you've got the smaller lenders like Macquarie growing really fast and ING and, you know, digital lenders, et cetera. Basically, all the banks are really competing really hard. You can see that through cashback offers. You can see back through the discounts they offer to new customers. But also their credit, they've also, because they had such massive influx turnaround times, and, you know, the quality of credit assessors really deteriorated the last couple of years just because they couldn't get enough talent to assess all these loans. And that was making credit assessments quite difficult. If you didn't know the bank, or you didn't have preferential treatment at a bank, you'd get an assessor that's been 2 weeks. You'd have to train them on why this, you know, loan fits policy and why they need to approve it. That's sort of been sort of solved a little bit. You know, credit's pretty smooth now, very limited questions. You can even see the way that banks are changing, you know, casual employment or cash out policies over the last couple of weeks, or increasing DTI limits. So decline loans aren't really happening. And the real issue where we saw in the 2018 where credit got really tight. And there was talk about this happening. There was talk about, before all the rate increases, there was talk that banks were going to have to put limits around DTI to slow the market down. That's why APRA came in last year. But, you know, that the assessment rate jumping up so much has taken that off the table, because you don't really get high DTI loans anymore because of that. So, it's pretty easy to get loans through. Banks do all the checks. They'll absolutely check your credit file. They'll absolutely check your pay slips and make sure everything's all right. But they just won't look at your expenses. You know, that was a fight that, you know, Martin covered a lot in the ASIC versus APRA, Westpac case, ASIC versus Westpac a couple of years ago. Since then, that's sort of the whole wording and the whole approach to expenses has gone back to kind of what it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other interesting question, and this is actually one from Caroline, who sent this in beforehand. She's got a fixed rate loan. She's got a mortgage of just under $1 million. The fixed rate loan is going to come to an end June next year. And she's looking at what the alternatives are now. And basically, she's going from about 2% to a significantly higher. And of course, the first question is, well, you know, if I do nothing, I then end up on a high variable rate loan. So, but this gap of 2% to 4 or 5%, you know, she's quite concerned about how to think about it. Any thoughts in terms of somebody facing into that potential gale? You know, what are the questions they should be asking themselves, Chris?
So if there's a genuine risk of potentially not paying under 5% interest rates, then you need to be getting prepared for it right now. You need to be getting buffers and building up cash and thinking about things you can sell, for example. You need to be right on top of this. You know, you can't be waiting to June and going, oh, no. So she's doing the right thing. You know, she's already October and she's worried about this next year. I don't think Jill's going to have a problem, right, because she's already thinking about things. Absolutely, she should think through what would buy repayment be if the RBA was at, say, 3.5% or 4%. What my home loan was, say, 5.5% or 6%. What would my repayment be? But also, what could I do to reduce that interest rate? You know, Jill could be on a, you know, even though she set up the loan a couple of years ago, or maybe she was an old customer and she fixed, she could easily be paying a loyalty tax on her variable rate. And, you know, that could reduce, you know, get it down to that 5.5%, 6%. She might, you know, be paying more than that. She could extend her loan term. Maybe she could do a redraw. She's probably got equity there. Depends on her income. There's lots of things that, you know, not just getting a better rate that a refinance could do is reduce her obligations every month. And that's the thing. A lot of people, you know, forget that, you know, through a refinance, what people do is extend their loan terms. And so they extend back to 30 years. So you've got a 25-year loan. Now you extend it to 30. Yes, you're paying a higher interest rate, but you've got to pay that money back over a longer time frame, and that reduces your repayment. You also got buffers and cash outs pretty easy now. So there's going to be ways for people to get around higher interest rates rather than affording it from salary. People do absolutely everything to not lose their home, especially if there's a chance of losing money. And so, you know, you just got to be when all of a sudden, bang, interest rates are going to jump up, and then all this is going to be this massive debt stress, and you're going to get all these people forced selling. That's just it's level one thinking. You know, you may see debt stress, but then that person's not going to get debt stress overnight. The bank's going to step in. It's going to take many months. It's going to be more prolific in some pockets than other pockets. It's a greater story than this. The other thing to remember is that, you know, 30, 40% of the properties in a established suburb are paid off. So they've got no debt. So higher interest rates is actually giving them more money, if anything. 30, 40% have probably got low debt because they're probably purchased more than 5 years ago. They've probably got on top of that debt and they've been paying that off. And they've been taking advantage of very low interest rates. And then you've got the last sort of 5 years where it's a bit higher debt, right? Some of them are doing well financially, some aren't. But the whole suburb isn't under a lot of debt stress. It's just a pocket is. And a lot of these suburbs are very low listings anyway. So if supply did increase in these suburbs, especially if they're quality assets, there's going to always be buyers in those suburbs and who want to upgrade into those suburbs. So even if more supply comes in this suburb, it's coming off a very low base, the very low listings. There's more than enough demand generally within borrowing capacity constraints to sort of pick up if people have to sell.
And you mentioned a very important comment there, the loyalty tax. Let's just unpack that a bit, right? Because it amazes me how many people are still on rates that are way above where they should be.
So what the banks do is it's very clever pricing in their mind. The thing is, Australians are getting very frustrated. You can see Mortgage Choice came out today with a partnership with Athena, which is a digital bank that gets as a non-bank and gets funding that way, right? And, you know, one of their pitch is that you stay on the same rate as new customers, right, which is awesome. And that would be awesome if all the banks did it. But that's not how they make money. It's not how they make profits. The way they make money is by their existing customers being a bit lazy. They play on their apathy and they just rely on them not being bothered to refinance their mortgage. And Australians historically have done that. They just thought, well, I'm happy here, been here, had my childhood bank account here. I'm not going to refinance. And that's happened, right? But what's happened is that the banks have been struggling due to competition, and brokers are a big part of this story. This isn't just pushing brokers, doing the trumpet thing. You know, it's 70% of loans are going through brokers right now. And brokers have got savvy customers because they're typing into Google, what's the best rate? And if they can't offer them a really good rate and the best in the market, then the customer knows that. And so brokers are upping their game. They're getting more and more away from just supporting the big banks and one bank. They're spending to more lenders. It's creating more competition. And banks are having to compete for competition more than ever. Cashbacks didn't exist a few years ago. ANZ came out with a bright idea and said, oh, look, we need more business. We'll do a cashback. And it absolutely worked. They got absolutely flooded. The turnaround times went from a day to 4 to 8 weeks. They couldn't handle it. All their customers actually finally did it and joined, but got such a poor experience. But all the banks realized it worked to give these, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 cashbacks. And now every bank offers a $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 cashback because they're just so desperate, And then a lot of them are loss making. I was chatting to an economist at a big consultancy earlier today. And a lot of banks think, when they're offering these such cheap pricing and cashbacks, if that client refinances in 2 to 3 years and they pay a broker, they're actually losing money. And so that's how fierce competition is. The way the loyalty tax works is that you get a standard variable rate at a bank, and then you negotiate a discount off that standard variable rate. So if you walk in off the street, you might get, 1.2 or 1.5%. But if you go through a broker or you know how to play the bank and you play them off against different banks, you might get a 2 or 2.5% discount. And that's how far discounts have moved. When I started in broking, back in 2014, a good discount was 1 or 1.2%. Now we're seeing discounts like over 2.5% now. So it's just crazy. Customers from 8 years ago are more than 1%, if not 1.5% out of the money. So if you haven't reviewed your home loan, the crazy thing is they've just moved so much in the last 6 months. So 6 months ago, you thought you were getting a good rate. Just 6 months later, the discounts for new customers moved so much that existing customers are already out of market. It's just, and the problem is the banks have always had issues with retention. It makes sense, right? Call up your bank and say, oh, I'm going to leave, give me a better deal. Banks have been pretty useless at that. Right, they just sort of went, oh no, we can't do anything better, or we'll give you 10 basis points, off you go. But the banks are knowing that customers aren't taking that anymore, and when rates are falling, customers just say, oh, it doesn't matter, I'm getting a better deal anyway. When rates are going up, people are like, well, that's costing me money, I need to get myself a better rate. And so all the banks are very scared over the next couple of years of the refinance that's going to happen, and, you know, the competition they're going to have to offer to their existing customers to give them better deals. So that's going to reduce bank profits. That's the only way to really sort of cut this.
Yeah, and of course the refinancing has gone through the roof. If you look at the statistics, it's a higher percentage for external refinancing than we've had for a long, long time. And interestingly, some of the analysis I've been doing, people are still actually pulling equity out as part of that refinance transaction. So they're actually building a little bit of extra buffer from the equity that they've got in the property as they refinance, and maybe even extend the term to deal with that. So there's a lot there. But the point is that, yeah, you can't assume if you've got a reasonable rate 6 months ago, you've still got a good rate now, right? That's the problem.
Yeah, it's quite. We've had a few clients come to us in the last couple of weeks, and they're like, "I'm pretty sure my rate's not that great." And we're like, "Yeah, it's sort of gone out of market in literally under 6 months." We go to the bank. Oh, we're not going to review it with under 12 months. you know, it's like, fortunately, we were fixing pretty much all our clients, and not all your loans. It's a pretty common mistake that I frustratingly see. People don't keep some variable with an offset account, but we were fixing 80-90% of our clients' loans for the last few years. And, you know, a lot of them sub 2% and a lot of them for 3-4 years. But we haven't really been fixing all this year unless a client really wants that certainty, which is we often talk them out of it anyway. Yeah, it's crazy coming off fixed rates in the next couple of years, because as your fixed rate comes up, you get a letter from the bank, may get a phone call, or the broker calls you, and then you're going to say, well, what's the best deal in the market? And so it's just going to create this awareness. I have to do something because I'm coming off my fixed rate. Well, what's the best? So I'll take action. I think it was Jan or Jill that, Jean, what was the lady's name with the question? She was basically asking, you know, what's she going to do in June next year? Just wait to next year. And as long as you've got your job, as long as you've got enough equity, and you've got 5 times your income is roughly what you want to borrow, $1 million. So maybe hopefully on a couple hundred grand, then just shop the market. You'll find there'll be crazy deals.
Absolutely. And don't panic. I always say to people, don't panic, you know, because the thing to do is to understand what's going on, think it through and make rational decisions, right? That doesn't mean doing nothing and leave it to the last minute and then just grab the first bus that comes by, right? It's really important to just sort of take your time and do the work and understand. And I find that quite often people assume they can't do anything at all until, you know, the day. Well, actually, start planning ahead. You know, it's always a good thing. Plan ahead.
Yep.
Now, Tony Lacandro, thanks for the super chat. So, Tony, appreciate that. Said, Canadian mortgage fraud undercover videos doing the rounds are frightening. And this is interesting because they actually are proving that in Canada, there's a lot of fraudulent activity in and around property and the mortgage sector, and particularly, you know, groups of solicitors and agents working together to be able to actually basically defraud and make huge profits. Now, it's interesting, of course, in Australia, we actually don't have a very good set of checks and balances here in the system either, do we? So what's your sense? You think fraud is a real issue here, or do you think it's actually a minority sport? What do you think?
Look, when there's potentially, I mean, you had that guy who, I'm a Liverpool fan. I think he even sponsored Liverpool, wasn't it? The Greek guy, what's his name? And he was doing fraud to the banks and, you know, very complex frauds. And so absolutely fraud exists, and it's always going to exist. It's impossible to sort of take that out of the system. You've got to ask, you know, why would you get yourself involved with that, right, from a broking point of view? And so the quality of these loans and on the markets they will be playing in as well would be interesting ones as well. I just don't think it's something that's prolific out there. Maybe I'm ignorant. I mean, we just wouldn't get that call. We would sniff it out pretty quickly. And all the brokers I know that are the top brokers wouldn't go anywhere near this stuff. So you'd have to be sort of playing with brokers that are desperate for work. And, you know, the average broker writes under $10 million a year. So it's like, I don't know. Maybe it's internally at banks or something like that. But really, you know, that's jail time. I don't know.
And I think actually it's quite... It seems to me that it's more likely to be quite structured and there'll be multiple parties involved, and I suspect there's some of that going on, but it's very hard to push it. I just worked some years ago looking at some of the mortgage books in a couple of lenders where we noticed some common threads, right? So it was a consistent agent, a consistent broker, a consistent solicitor, and then you looked at the deal and thought, Oh, that's a bit weird, right? And then you started to see the same pattern appear again and again and again across the portfolio. And you realize that actually this was something that actually was structured. That's what I think we see. Now, I don't know to what extent the banks have systems to flush it out, because we flushed it out by looking at all the manual paperwork, because the systems really didn't tell enough to be able to actually flush it all out. And that was a pretty long and complicated manual process to go back over the particular transaction sets and look at the underlying documentation. But once you see the pattern, you can say, oh, well, you know, this is quite clear. So it does happen in Australia sometimes.
Yeah, I imagine it would. I mean, we take bank statements for our clients, and so we always match their income to their bank statements. And so, yeah, someone could send us some, you know, fake pay slips, but we pretty much figure it out very quickly by looking at, you know, their LinkedIn profile, their bank account. Oh, this person doesn't make sense. But, yeah, absolutely, some people may not be doing the due diligence and loans may be going through, and maybe the bank assessor's not doing the same checks, but I don't know. I just don't think it's a prolific thing here. Maybe I'm wrong.
And Jason added to it, basically saying, where there's money, there'll be fraudsters around the peripheral system. And that's spot on, I think. There are meant to be checks and balances in place. And, you know, I guess the point is that sometimes the systems are good enough to catch it, but I would suggest not. And indeed, the point about the Canadian situation is they were tripping over more and more examples of structural fraud, to the point where effectively a lot of the transaction base was actually potentially contaminated. So it's hard to know. And of course, we don't have huge amounts of obligations on real estate agents and solicitors and people, you know, in certain circumstances, do we? So always an interesting question.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I would talk about is this concept of being a mortgage prisoner, because we see a lot of it in the press, a lot of discussion about it. Being a mortgage prisoner a real thing?
Well, absolutely. It's not the first time we've had this chat too, Martin. We can sort of see it with the interest only a few years ago, where people could take out massive loans in 2014, 2015, you know, 10 times income. They got them all on 5 years interest only. So, you know, even 10 or 15 years interest only you could get back then. And they're all rolling off at a, you know, the interest only cliff, it was probably we spoke about, you know, a few years ago. And they're going to be a prisoner because they can't refinance. They've got to go principal and interest. You know, you can also, we saw it in 2018, similar thing, you know, people got stuck, couldn't refinance. They were going through bank statements, et cetera. So, you know, this is a common issue, and it absolutely is right now, because borrowing capacities have fallen probably 25, maybe 30%, you know, if you look at it, you know, when the RBA rate was sort of 0.1, it's gone up 2.5% since then. Every, you know, 1% is 10%, basically, to a reduction to borrowing capacity. So 2.5 is 25. And, you know, if you basically borrowed at your max and your income hasn't risen, then, you know, if you basically wouldn't be able to borrow the amount of money that you borrowed last year. And so you can't refinance. And if you then come off a fixed rate and you go onto a variable rate that's not on a very, very good variable rate, and you're at a bank that's not reviewing their existing customers fairly, I think this is something that ASIC really probably should be watching. You know, yes, people are, you can't be taking advantage of these people, I guess. And I think that the bank's got to be careful here, because they do, if the customer does think they're getting taken advantage, it doesn't take much for them to all of a sudden be able to refinance. Maybe they pay down their loan, maybe they get a, you know, increase in income, maybe capacity in, you know, APRA drops the buffer and, you know, borrowing capacity goes back up, or, and then all of a sudden they're going to get out of that bank. They're never going to want to go back to that bank if they don't look after them. And so, you know, CBA have sort of come out and said they're going to be pretty good around the pricing. And, you know, we're starting to see banks get much better around that. So, yeah, the issue of being a mortgage prisoner is you can't refinance and you're on a poor rate and you're basically paying over the odds until you can get out of prison and until you can refinance, basically. And, you know, so you've got a capacity issue change. You've also got property value falls. Like, even if you took an 80% loan out, you thought, oh, I'm fine, I've got, but that property's fallen 15%. Well, your property value, let's say it was $1 million, now worth 850, your loan was 800. Well, you can't refinance because you haven't got enough equity to go somewhere else. So absolutely, that would be happening right now as well.
Yeah. And in fact, there's a question from somebody who sent a question through, didn't want to give their name, but they basically are in the situation where they've got a fixed rate. It's coming up, but the borrowing capacity that they can now borrow at has dropped by about 30%.
Yeah.
Which means they can't actually now get the same loan that they've already got again.
Oh, yeah, that would be massively, you know, 25% of loans, let's say, for the last 2 years have been lent over six times DTI.
Yep.
And, you know, five times DTI is probably where we're at now. So it's more than 25% of loans. Now, bearing in mind, you know, it does make sense. You know, sometimes people don't really get this. It does make sense to borrow up to 80%. And that even if you've got the cash, you can put it into an offset account because you've got this big buffer. So even if you only needed to borrow $500,000 and you wanted to buy a $1 million property, you know, it would make sense to borrow $800,000 and put $300,000 into your offset account rather than just borrow $500,000 and have no buffer. You pay exactly the same amount of interest rate. Interest, because it'd be the net loan, which is 500. There is a bit of an interest rate challenge there that's sort of, you know, the LVR pricing starting to come more prolific and you may be paying a higher rate for 80% versus 70%. But if you're not, then, you know, you're not paying any additional cost to have 300 grand as a buffer. And you lose your job, something happens to your health, you may not be able to go and re-borrow that money. And, you know, if interest rates jump on you, then you're protected, et cetera. So, but that would go down on file that you borrowed at six times DTI because you borrowed at 80%, not 500. And so that those sort of things that do skew the numbers a little bit. But yeah, absolutely. There'd be lots of people out there that have borrowed a higher, 80% LVRs or 90%. Property prices have fallen and their incomes have fallen and, you know, they'd be stuck. And yeah, they're the people a bit more at risk here because if you run out of money, you can't refinance, you can't go back and borrow more money. So you've absolutely got to stay on top of your repayments.
And so in that situation where they are unable now to get the loan that's required to be able to effectively refinance the mortgage they've currently got, right? The fixed rate is ending. Presumably if they do nothing, then the bank automatically puts them on the standard variable.
There's a revert rate that you're saying, yeah. Then you basically got to, you can negotiate that back down to match your variable rate, right? But then you could ask for a better deal, right? And, you know, some banks will look at it like they were in the past and saying, well, you've got no chance of refinancing. And this is why we did under 1% of our loans with non-banks. We've never been a fan of using non-banks. We think if you're stretching your capacity that far and a big lender won't lend to you, and then these non-banks get into funding issues and they cannot... you know, it's do or die for them. Are they going to give you a better rate when you're a mortgage prisoner? Absolutely not. Yeah. And this is a big issue. The non-banks lending went through the roof. A lot of people stretched, went to non-banks, and now all of a sudden you're stuck at a non-bank paying a ridiculously high rate and you can't leave. And that could be 2 or 3% above, because it was already a high margin when you joined it potentially, above what you could get elsewhere. And so, yeah, it's one of the non-bank risks that people didn't really foresee. They were like, well, it's fine. I just wanted to borrow the money. I always refinance their loan. Well, no, you can't refinance. Now you're on a higher rate. Yeah, we saw the writing on the wall because we'd seen that happen in 2018. We've seen it happen in previous cycles as well.
Yeah, and Chris, the question I've got then is the bank is, I think, obliged to do another underwriting review when – you know, there's a significant change. Like, would they have to do if it reverted fixed to variable?
No, they're not going to do like a margin call on property.
No.
You know, but, like that is, it's not in the bank's interest, right? It's not in society's interest.
Aren't they obliged under the APRA rules to do it?
No, it's in your sort of loan contract that you had a 30-year loan. The first 5 years was interest only. You want a fixed loan. And then after that, it goes to a variable loan. They won't look at your situation.
No.
Look, if you want a fix, a lot of banks will let you do that as well without having to go through a full situation. A change would probably be going from principal and interest to interest only. Absolutely, that would be a or trying to extend your loan term or borrow a little bit more money. These things that absolutely have to go through. But just coming off a fixed rate, it's not a full assessment. Absolutely, if something like that happened, Martin, then you basically say, right, this 25% of borrowers, you know, can't re-borrow the money there. You have to all sell it. And that's basically putting a margin call on property. That's not, as we know, that's not in the bank's interest. And, you know, things like what happened in COVID will probably start happening, right? These payment holidays and all these sort of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's an interesting observation that, you know, there are some people saying, well, you know, will the banks have to go through that similar process and, you know, allow people more latitude and what have you. And certainly there are examples from people I've spoken with where the bank has said, well, maybe you should go back to interest only for a period to try and actually just reduce the burden of the repayments because, you know, it's not feasible at the moment to basically pay the whole lot. So it'll be interesting to see whether that sort of bubbles up to the surface again. Because, of course, interest only in one sense gives you a bit of flexibility, but you still have to repay the capital in due course.
And interest rates are high. Mm. So, you know, if you're paying 5% on $1 million, that's still over $4,000 a month, right? Maybe your repayments have dropped from 6 to 4. And if you couldn't afford it at $4,000, let's say, now the bank's going to be saying, hang on a sec, what's happened with your work? And is it a short-term gap or is this a systemic issue? And have you been really just... And I do think it's going to be a bit of a mix. It's maybe not going to be that blanket. Anyone can get a payment holiday, but it does make sense for the banks and does make APRA sense to, within reason, give the banks ability to do some type of, you know, extra support because of the huge jump in interest rates. And, you know, the government's also got a, you know, was saying rates weren't going to jump to 2024. Not that anyone really believed that, but, you know, they were constantly out there sort of pumping that message, right? And so, I think they'll use that as a reason to say, hang on a sec, maybe we should offer these payment holidays. So these clients, as long as you tick all these boxes, you've been perfectly paying on time forever. You're just having a bit of financial stress, but you're going to do something about it. And yeah.
I think they'll find a way. And the other point you mentioned, the APRA 3% buffer, right? Now, of course, when rates were very low, 3% was a long way above where rates actually are. Now rates have come up. In fact, some people are now above the buffer. But it's unlikely, possibly, that rates are going up another 3% from where we currently are. So do you think APRA is likely to squeeze the 3%?
Look, I think once rates stabilise, I think, you know, it's hard to argue that you should decrease the buffer when rates are still going up month by month, right? Mm. But, you know, if the RBA does stop and it starts, let's say it stops at, I don't know, it's a mug's game trying to pick, you know, decide where interest rates are going to land, right? And it's constantly changing. But let's say it stops at 3.5 or 4, whatever. It doesn't really matter. At that point, you know, you'd have to argue that a 3% buffer would be a 7% RBA rate after, you know, the greatest increase in interest rates, you know, on living memory, right, would be a bit over the top. And, you know, it makes sense for the APRA to not only try to slow down the market, but to try to encourage it, all right? And, you know, to support the banking system, you know, that's obviously what it's trying to do. And so it went from a 2.5% buffer to a 3% buffer. Absolutely, I wouldn't be surprised for it to go to 2.5. A lot of the top economists think that. But would it go to 2? You know, that'd be a 10% increase in borrowing capacity to offset, you know, what's just happened. And so, yeah, there's talk of that happening. I mean, there's also talk that, you know, they're going to have to over-tighten because of the fixed rates and they're going to have to then potentially reduce rates after that, you know. So, you know, maybe that would be another increase to borrowing capacity. Major wage increases start to flow through, et cetera. So, yeah, it's a real timing thing at the moment. It's a really tight credit market. So if you're in the market right now and you have got great borrowing capacity because you're trying to borrow well within your maximum and you want to be in the market and you've got your deposit, well, you're the dream buyer right now. That dream buyer last year kept getting pushed out, even though because there's always someone willing to go into more and more debt. But right now, they can knock those buyers out because they've got you know, more cash and more borrowing capacity than they need, and they can stay in the market. Their buyers are having to reduce their budgets and look at different markets, but they can just stay in their market because their borrowing capacities aren't falling. And that's really the dream position to be in. So if you're in that position right now, it's a really strong place to be patient. The dangerous thing right now is to buy a poor asset, and most of the properties on the higher portion of properties on the market now are poor assets, because why would you sell a quality asset right now? A, you can't find another good one, and B, you know it's not a great time to sell, and C, you just don't want to do an upgrade right now because you're worried about building costs or you're worried about the additional debt at higher interest rates, etc. So the market's seizing up of quality assets. It happens in every sort of downturn. And so the dangerous thing is right now, you look online, oh, I want to take action. Everything's poor. Oh, I'm just going to buy something, you know, be a bit of a bargain hunter and just get into the market. If things continue to get worse than expected, those properties that are already formed will keep on getting repriced because they're less enticing to take on under higher interest rates. And they're more compromised and people are willing to take less risks on them. So you just got to be very careful with the market right now. And buying those properties in any markets is always a risk, right? It's always about being patient and quality. The good news is if you do find something that is actually a really quality property, which we could talk about, you know, your chance of getting it's actually quite high because competition is quite, you know, small. People are very apprehensive on making offers. They're sitting on their hands. They want to see what's happening in the market. That's the dream buying conditions. All your competition are basically wanting to see what happens till they make a move, and you can sort of come in there and make a solid offer. The vendor is very nervous about what it could potentially be worth in the future. Should they take that offer? Actually, yeah, we don't want to be that person who said no to that offer and sold it for less 3 months, 3 weeks later. That's sort of what we're seeing.
Yeah. Now, you touched on another very important point, and in fact, it came through in about four or five questions that I've got here from people.
Yeah.
When Chris comes on, he always talks about a high-quality asset. This is from Fred, actually, this one. What does he mean by a high-quality asset? What differentiates a high-quality asset from a low-quality asset? And does it change over time? And, can you sort of paint a pen picture of what a high-quality asset might actually look like?
Okay. So ideally the suburb, let's say you want to have a suburb that appeals to people earning higher incomes, right, or a location that appeals. Because if people aren't earning higher incomes, higher than average incomes, incomes is what drives their capacity to borrow money. It also allows them to take on debt, which allows them to push up prices, right? And so places that don't appeal to people on higher incomes, you're only going to appeal to people with a lot of cash. And a lot of people with cash don't also want to move to these locations. They want to stay where their family are and their kids are, et cetera. So that's the first thing. And that's why certain markets will struggle if they don't appeal to that. But once you're in those locations, think about a suburb. Some parts of that suburb are the most desirable parts, right? Maybe it's got the greatest access to amenity. Some roads are really busy. Is that going to make a great asset when you've got buses and cars and noise and out the front? Well, no. So the inner suburb, you've got pockets that people don't really want. Maybe it's too far away from the train station. Maybe it's noisy. Maybe it's got housing commission. Maybe it's got, escarpment issues. Maybe it's, got lots of issues, right? Got rat runs through there where people are. So out of suburbs, you've got a macro picture and you've got a suburb level, and then you've got inside that suburb, then you've got a few streets that everyone really wants to be on. And usually there's very little development. They're usually quiet. They're really perfect for families. And maybe in good suburbs, for example, there's maybe heritage overlays. And so when you come back in, do they change over time? Is that really going to be the best pocket of that suburb? Yes. Is it going to stay there? Yes. The reason is because nothing's going to change. And where the rest of the suburb is building apartments and changing, that little pocket's this little sanctuary. And there's little sanctuaries around the city that basically through NIMBYism that people won't change. Maybe it's trees, et cetera. So when you're thinking about a quality asset, you want to be in there. You also want to buy an asset that they're not building more of. So if you think about like a high density apartment, yeah, it might be the best part of that suburb, but then they're building lots of what you've got. So you need restricted supply. And ideally, you want to hit the family market. Singles don't really only got one income. Couples are a bit got sport for choice. They can look at lots of options. They're not forced to buy property, so there's always a limit. But once you get to the family market, there's very little options for them. We just haven't built three-bed apartments, so they really need to move into the townhouses and apartments and houses. And that's where there's a real lack of scarcity, and we can't really build lots of them, right? We could build more three-bed apartments, but developers don't really want to build those. There's more money in one and twos and studios. It's an area where there's very low new buildings. It's usually an area where high-income families want to live. And in those suburbs, it's on the better streets. Then once you're in those streets, there'll be some properties that, have got really bad light issues, so maybe they're south-facing. So then the north-facing ones are better. You've got better floor plans than other ones. You've got maybe heritage overlays. You've got privacy issues. You've got lots of things that you overlay to say, it's a good part of that suburb. It's a good property, but there's something about it that's flawed, and that basically rules it out. So most properties have got some type of deal breaker, which, turns some buyers off. It's about compromises a buyer makes from a lifestyle or a livability point of view. So hopefully that shows how deep you go. Now, it's not to say that you could apply that to any city and or any part of a city. And you'll find that those pockets in those suburbs turn over less, because where people are in that pocket, they want to stay in that pocket. And so when they turn over less, that means less. There's already a smaller number of them, and there's less of them turning over every year, which means there's actually less of them to buy every year. And people live in them for longer, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And on that, you said a little while ago, which I thought was interesting, that in the current environment, a lot of the property that's actually on the market currently is not in that A grade. You know, it's stuff that hasn't sold. It's stuff that needs to be sold. Often it's the case that the most attractive properties are the ones that disappear off the market first, particularly when the market's a little bit less buoyant.
Yep. So anyone listening to this right now can look at their suburb and they will know what streets are the ones that are constantly turning over. They're not the properties everyone really aspires to be in. They want to be in these quieter back streets, right? You'll find that there's streets that just haven't sold a property in 10 years. There's a reason for that. And so every time that property comes on the market in that street, everyone's like, oh, I really want to be in that street. All of a sudden you've got competition. But then you've got that busy road where they're constantly turning over. So I'm up on the northern beaches in Bilgola, right? You know, there's a few roads that are constantly got people turning over their property. They buy them, 2 years later they move out because it's a rat run or it's noisy and it's a main road or it's unsafe for kids, et cetera. Or it's got, you know, escarpment issues or it's dark or it's south facing. So you could easily figure these things out if you just sort of put a bit of critical thinking in your suburb. And then you compare the growth of those properties, because that's where people go nuts. They hold their value in downturns because there's less supply and people are always willing to go into them. But in the boom, the person with the most money in the suburb goes and spends it on the best property in the suburb and it pushes the price up. And you can easily do a comparison. It's not to say you can't make money on the other properties, is you lose the ability to control when you sell. So if you buy one of the poorer properties in the suburb, you have to sell it in a boom. You have to sell when there's FOMO, because that discount between the good suburb, the good properties and the bad properties really tightens up, because everyone tries to get the better properties. They can't get that. They get desperate and they overpay for the poor properties like 2021, 2017. But in the moment, you'll see the good properties are holding their value because they're not turning over. The poor properties, people are going, I'm not going to make those compromises, and that gap gets bigger. And so, you know, it's just in this market, you'd absolutely get smashed. You'd pay overs for a poor property in the boom, and then you would get a pretty fire sale price right now if you had to sell.
And I think that's a very important observation. And in fact, I do quite a lot of work with Cookie Boy looking at price falls. And we've seen quite a lot of price falls, for example, in around Brisbane, for example, at the moment. And if you look closely, a lot of the property that's on the market up in around Brisbane is in that second or third tier, right? So there's a lot of prices that are sliding down.
I was shocked to see how much they grew up. Brisbane market went absolutely nuts. We had lots of clients buying in Brisbane, you know, 700 to 1.1 million range in 2016, 2017. And, you know, we're talking inner ring suburbs, you know, 4 or 5 Ks, you know, Barden, Woolloongabba, Balmoral, Graceville, all the places around the river, right? And, you know, for that 700 to a million, you could get an older Queenslander that maybe was renovated 5-10 years ago that's totally rentable and a really good yield back then. And if people were going to leave Sydney or Melbourne to move to Brisbane, that's where they'd want to be. Replicate what they would love to have in Sydney in that city. And absolutely, those properties all pretty much doubled in the space of 2 years. It was a huge, huge boom. But what was shocking in Brisbane is that boom went all the way out to the outer rings. It was just a complete FOMO up there. And, you know, you saw 40, 50% increases in prices in areas where they couldn't sustain, you know, the incomes weren't to sustain those prices under higher rates. And you had a lot of investors in this space. A lot of spruikers pushed people to the growth corridors in Brisbane and Gold Coast and, you know, the quantity strategy in places like Logan and Kalingar and, Moreton Bay and, all these areas. And a lot of investors realized they were dud properties and they had an opportunity to get out last year, and they did. And so you could easily see this oversupply in the market. New buyers can't afford higher interest rates. They just got FOMO last year. And there's no choice, and they're homogenous stock. There's nothing special about them. And so buyers are like, well, every property is the same. I'm just going to sit on my hand and see what happens with prices. There's no urgency. There's no like fear. If I don't buy now, I'll never be able to buy, because there's just so much supply. And that's unfortunately what's happening there. All that price growth for the last 2 years is probably unwinding. It potentially could even go lower than what it was 2 years ago, because we're talking much higher rates than 2 years ago. You know, that's the thing. Not only have rates gone up, they've gone higher than what they were, pre-boom. And that's something that people aren't thinking through.
Absolutely. Well, it's certainly at the moment, it looks as though some of those areas around Brisbane, they're falling faster than pretty much anywhere else. Although the northern beaches actually also look quite wobbly. We might explore that in a second, because I think actually there's some really interesting stories there where people got a bit over-exuberant, over-leveraged. They've got big mortgages, right, because the property prices were quite extended. What are you seeing there in the Northern Beaches?
So I'm on the beaches, and so absolutely, beaches corrected 15 to 20% pretty much in the first month. And this is the thing, when people look at data, they go, oh, Sydney market's down. Well, no, the beaches fell 15, 20% in the space of a couple of months. The quality of properties coming on the market, the number of properties has really dried up though. So, you know, there's four properties for sale in my suburb. You know, there's only a handful available, you know, in other suburbs around, right? And if you look at the best pockets of those suburbs, there's pretty much no real properties. At the top end, they got really burnt. There's a lot of money coming across from the eastern suburbs. And money was sort of flowing a lot. And so I think that area did pull back a lot. Look, the beaches went up the most, right? And so, yeah, there's a pullback, but it's really burning the people who bought in late 2021.
Yep.
And who potentially happened to sell. So, absolutely, there's a huge repricing happening in the beaches.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I've got postcode-specific data now, which includes the census data, the data from my surveys, and we quite often look at things like what the disposable monthly income is and what proportion is going on the mortgage, right? And in quite a lot of these Northern Beaches suburbs, we're seeing people with, you know, not just 30, but 35 or even 40 or 42 or 43% of their income on that mortgage at the moment because the rates have gone up, which suggests to me that there's going to be more trouble ahead in that particular area. And I guess my question is then, in that situation, where you maybe start to get distressed sales, does that create opportunity or does that just create more mayhem? How does it play out? The beach
is a pretty desirable pocket, right? That was always discounted because of the commute, return to work, and that sort of all shifted with COVID, right? And that's why it had one of the biggest price growth, right? Because the eastern suburbs was really expensive. People didn't want to live in the beaches because it was too far away. Actually, no, I need to go to get to the city 2 days a week. I can move to the beaches. And the issue you're going to see with a lot of that debt stress is that the buyers that were moving there were the young families that were who were basically backing themselves to take on a bigger mortgage so they could lock in a home for their families long term. So I think you also find that, you know, it doesn't assume that incomes are the same, assumes that they're not earning more money than they were a couple of years ago. A lot of the people taking on those bigger mortgage are backing themselves to earn more money. And so I think you'll find that. And you will see debt stress in markets where you've got a lot of that sort of first home, not their first family home. Maybe they had an apartment before, or they're trying to get into something that's going to really suit them long term. People do stretch, but they stay there and they're not taking on more debt, and they work on their incomes and they get on top of their mortgages. And yes, absolutely, some of them will be surprised under higher interest rates, and we'll have to be, you know, doing things to stay on top of their mortgages. But do they rush to sell everything they've worked for hard to sell in this market and lose everything? Probably not. They do everything they can to hold on, right? They're confident on the market. They're confident on their property. In areas where they're not, absolutely, sometimes people say, well, don't get out now. I'm going to be left with nothing. You're more likely to see a fire sale, right? But I think they're confident that, you know, supply will be tight. And they're going to stay here long term. They're just going to suck up the higher interest rates and get through. It's really a case of how long, which was a question before, how long do rates stay high, right? And do they go lower? No one knows the answers to those questions, right? And that's something that's going to have to play out, and we'll have to, you know, in 2 years' time, the rate's still at 5%, you know, or they're lower. And that's where you'll see more of these debt stresses. It's going to be an accumulating thing if rates stay high for a long time.
Mm. Yeah, and of course the question is nobody quite knows where rates are going to go. Well, it's worth reflecting on the forward view from the ASX. This is the ASX 30, right? So it's basically saying 4%. Out through next year and into the first part of the following year, so 2024. That's the cash forward projection, which would suggest that rates will stay high. And the RBA today, when they released their minutes for the meeting, basically said, we went 25, but we're going to do more 25s. So they're not looking as though they're going to actually take rates down. Though it's interesting, of course, that you know, some of the banks are saying, oh, they won't go much higher. Others are saying, no, they're going to go quite a lot higher. Nobody quite knows. But interestingly, New Zealand, they did 50, and then they've pretty much revealed the inflation's very high. They can probably do another 50 in November. So I think rates are going to stay high. So I think people need to be planning for higher rates for longer. And I don't know what you think, Chris, but it seems to me that quite a few people in the industry, particularly the real estate agents, are really sort of encouraging people to think this is a temporary blip and it's going to come back down. I'm not sure that's a really smart way of planning, though.
Yeah, I mean, the reason they're going high is to slow things down, right? And, you know, it's a recession we might have to have, you know, et cetera, right? But, you know, on the other side of that coin, you know, if they do get inflation under control, what's the benefit to having them as high? You know, they already said what the term, what's the neutral cash rate's at 2.5, right? And so, you know, there would be incentives if we do see, you know, inflation under control and lower growth, which is what they're trying to do, that they're going to want to reduce the cash rate. And so, yeah, absolutely. You could say in your mind, I need to be able to afford higher interest rates, and it makes sense to do that. But then to potentially never make a decision around property because you're worried about higher rates, I think that's a, yeah. And then all of a sudden you get surprised. And so, yeah, I think you just, people get surprised at the property market, and that's the thing, you know. Like, you know, what your channel has been producing content for many years, right? And you constantly get surprised, right? With, you know, what happens, right?
Yep.
And I think we will be surprised because things will happen next year that we didn't expect. No one expected rates to jump up this much, and I think it's you know, this conversation is an evolving conversation, and who's to say that in 6-12 months' time we aren't? It was even 3 months ago that I thought the rates wouldn't go as high as this. You know, it was all over the banks. You know, the RBA is only going to go to 3.5. Now we're saying it's going to 4. Well, who's to say, you know, inflation in 3 months' time we just go back to 3.5?
Or inflation might be still bubbling away. You know, look at the rentals coming through, and you know, nobody knows. That's why I always talk about scenarios, Chris. Right?
Yeah.
I think it helps people to think about, if rates go high, if rates go low, what does that do, right? Because you need to play, I always think it's important to at least play the counterfactual, right?
Mm.
So if you have a belief that rates are going to go down, great, you make your plans on that. But also ask yourself the question, what if I'm wrong? What if rates stay high? You know, how will I cope? It's that sort of thinking that I think is really important at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone's been surprised at how much rates have gone up in the last, you know, 6 months, right? And so that's really taught everyone a lesson, you know, how much they've jumped, how fast. But I mean, a lot of people thought that, you know, rates would stay high, you know, in COVID and the property market would fall 20%. So if you made that decision in, you know, in the height of COVID or in 2018, 2019, and look at where prices are, so every price has fallen another 20%, they're nowhere near what they were, you know, back then. And so you just got to be careful when you make these calls. If you get it wrong, yeah, I'm not saying that, you know, that this is what's going to happen in the future. But I'm just saying that when people make big financial calls, whether they try to sit out of the market or whether they decide to buy in, both of those are decisions and both have consequences.
Absolutely.
And you can sit on the fence and say, I didn't lose money because I didn't buy. Well, you did lose money because you got an opportunity cost of not taking action. And I would say that there'd be thousands of people probably in your that have constantly sat on the fence, and sat on the fence the last 10 years been waiting for the perfect market to buy. And, you know, they're constantly waiting, and they're constantly waiting for some miraculous crash. Well, it could be 40% of what it was last year, but it's still up from what it was 3 years ago. Yeah, I just sort of want to highlight that because I think that, you know, it unfortunately becomes this negative confirmation bias. You start believing it, you'll start convincing yourself, and you start switching off that, you know, the story will continue long over the next then a couple of years' time.
And look, comparing property with, let's say, stocks and shares, right, over this year, you know, you probably say that property has been a little more stable than stocks and shares.
Well, absolutely. I mean, now's a great time. I'm not saying it's from a financial advice point of view, but if anything, you're saying, well, there's been discounting to the stock market right now. Why aren't I, you know, starting to drip feed money into the market, you know? Yeah, I probably won't talk about that right now because it's probably going to step into a wrong lane. But, yeah, I think people, you know, think, oh, I don't want to buy now because I don't want to lose money. Well, okay, so but you want to buy in 2020 and 2021, then there's all-time highs and people are paying that many multiples for that share. You know, it's just behavioral finance. Mm. And, yeah, unfortunately, people want to see when the herd moves, you know. And so what will happen?
Lemmings.
Absolutely. We'll get back to next year. The thing is, you're going to see a supply shrinkage. It's harder to buy good quality properties in down markets, right? And that's just the truth, right? So you can buy poor stuff. That's easy, right? And it's a risky move because you've got to hope that the market recovers and you've got to be able to sell it in a boom. I just think it's not worth the risk. But if you can buy a quality asset, it's going to be harder. Listings aren't really going to come on the market in November. Like, you would just be game to list your property in November this year. Days of markets come out because your property could easily sit on the market in Christmas. Agents go, vanish in January, and then a flood of new listings may come on in February that are, yours is stale. It's down the bottom of the search. You wouldn't want that. And so, you know, pretty much if a property doesn't come on in the next 2 weeks, then it's probably not going to come on till February. And, you know, depending on what happens in the world, you are going to see buyers that you had the opportunistic buyer was probably buying the last 3-4 months. But what we're seeing is the must-do upgrader is starting to come to the market, you know, because they're saying, well, we've already factored in a certain price fall. Yeah, I could potentially see further price falls, but I'm seeing how hard it is to buy a quality asset. I've been looking for 3 months. I can't find anything. I've seen one property, which I've missed out on. So I think they're going to start to come to the market. We're already seeing that happening. And so these people are backing themselves from a trajectory point of view. They know they can afford higher interest rates if they stay there. And so they're starting to come to the market. And January, it is usually quite busy. You can easily see that in previous years where the market can easily jump. And so you may see new buyers come in. You've got stamp duty change potentially coming through in the next few weeks. I'm not exactly sure where that's at. I know it's coming into Parliament. But that's a massive demand influx, you know, once that gets out widespread. You know, anyone under 1.5 is a first-time buyer needs a 10% deposit, not 15. That's huge. And so you could say, yeah, all of a sudden the negative news cycle can easily start flipping positive. I'm not saying this is going to happen now, but you could easily start to see this. And you all of a sudden start chasing your tail. The open homes are quite busy. Oh, wait, hang on a sec. There's a bit of competition. I can't make offers anymore. People aren't saying, oh, I have to go to auction. Oh, wait, that actually went for a decent price compared to what I thought. Oh, wait, maybe I should try to buy again. Oh, wait, I can't buy in this suburb anymore. Maybe I should look at another suburb. And then all of a sudden you start chasing your tail. And then you think you've missed the boat and then you sit out and then you've missed the bounce back. That has happened many times to many people.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, Chris, isn't it, that actually it doesn't need a huge amount of increase or decrease in volume for the market to switch one way or the other, right?
That's a really good point, Martin. Exactly. So if you're on a very low tight listings, you don't need we had a client buy a property last week. It was a complete AAA property. This property is on an amazing inner ring, a lower north suburb, amazing street, north facing, beautiful frontage, great land, the pool, renovated meticulously, really beautiful, great neighbors, awesome privacy, all the things that make a dream property. You know, parking off street, you know, a little park just down the road. Like literally it was a cracking property, great part of the suburb, you know, easy access to the shops and the train and everything like that. In any other market, that property's going super hot. And the only reason the seller was selling is because they do flips. They hold properties 3 to 5 years. They make a bit of money and then they upgrade. They probably wish they did the flip last year, but then they were going to buy. They usually buy up. So they were selling to then go and buy again. And they think it's a better market to upgrade in, which it is. But that property still had three people competing. It still went over 15% above the price guide. Because everyone's like, well, I've been looking. This is by far the best property I've seen. I've been looking for 3 months. I don't want to wait another 3 months. I'm just going to make an offer. And all of a sudden, you had a little round robin. The difference was it had three people really keen on it instead of 10 or 15, which an agent would run an auction. And so, yeah, that's sort of some things we're seeing.
Now, here's a question from a little earlier on, which was basically looking at the immigration particularly. Will the predicted high immigration have an impact on the market? Because, of course, we know that there are a lot of visas being issued at the moment. The taps are being opened. The flood is going to come in. How does that impact the market, do you think, Chris?
Look, but you don't all of a sudden just move to Australia and a lot of them are students, et cetera, and all of a sudden you buy a property, right? It usually takes a few years for you to build up the savings, to get the jobs, to know whether you want to stay. And so there's a lag with migration. It's like when people were saying in COVID, oh, there's no migration, property prices are going to fall. Well, no, they're buyers that we're going to buy in 2 or 3 years' time. And maybe some of the temporary visas wouldn't be buying anyway because of stamp duty and things like that. So, you know, all of a sudden migration isn't going to be here and bang, you're going to see. You are going to see stress in the rental market, which is already under a lot of stress, right? Whether people can sustain these higher rents is a different question. Yeah, rents are going up. It doesn't mean, you know, as all of them roll off, they can keep on sustaining higher rental increases. I think that's a bit of a myth. And a lot of new properties are getting built. You can just walk around Rosebery in Sydney or Docklands in Melbourne or you'll see a lot of new supply. So absolutely, it'll put a stress on the rental market. Look, these are future buyers. If these are high income, highly skilled people, which we're trying to encourage, and they're, you know, and then they have a partner and they've got two incomes, they will absolutely. The interesting thing with migration, if people are moving to, let's call it Sydney, they generally speaking, we have noticed a difference up post-COVID, want to be in the city or in a ring city. So when their friends and family visit, they want that city lifestyle. That's why they moved to Sydney. They've also, a lot of them have grown up in apartments, not stereotypical, you know, backyard, you know, that in Australia, for example. And so they're more than happy just to have a really nice apartment in a suburb that offers a really great lifestyle. And, you know, they can send their kids to the local school. So that, generally speaking, you know, that's where houses are really expensive, but you get like the Art Deco apartments, maybe it's Lower North Shore, or, you know, Lower Beaches, or places like Rose Bay or parts of Balmain, where, yeah, that migration, that high income, highly skilled migration will support those markets, which have already got limited supply, because they offer a viable housing solution or property solution for young families that are on high incomes. And so, yeah, that's where the migration thing, it will take more debt stress on the rental market, which is already under low vacancy rates within certain pockets. And then it creates future demand in years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're making a very good point about the effect will be, you know, slow and extended rather than a sort of a mighty wash, you know, just a few months. It takes a long time for people to actually to come and settle and those sorts of things. But the rental market will hit it first, I think. Now, this one came in a little while ago. What do you think about the Help to Buy scheme? That's, you know, the shared equity that the current government is sort of pushing, right? So you own a bit of a house rather than the full house, and the government owns the other half of it. What's your view on that?
It's a tough one, right? It's just trying to create future demand. I think there is a key worker issue, and, you know, some of our most important jobs don't get the salaries that they deserve or need to live in the city, and we're pushing them out, which is creating, you know, unstable societies really longer term, right? So we do have a key worker issue. So if you're going to do something like that, it should be targeted to them. And, you know, they should have flexibility in terms of what they buy. Like, you don't want to go and do a Help to Buy if you buy a poor asset, you know, because you're missing an opportunity. And so you've just got to make sure that you actually are getting a good asset. I do think things like that are going to pop up. But I mean, have they got the scale to solve these problems at mass? I think there should be a partnership with super funds, which is starting to come more and more in the media. It was out, you know, a couple of weeks ago. We were banging on about this years ago on our podcast. $2 trillion superannuation system that, you know, does look for long-term steady income streams. So if the tax rules around build-to-rent changed, it could make sense for super funds to go in partnership with governments and to develop land that could be, you know, key worker accommodation. It's a win-win for the super fund, but it's also a win for providing key worker accommodation under build-to-rent where they can live long-term. So I think the government needs to get a bit more creative. I do think they sort of Help to Buy. I mean, there's apparently the Singapore model is really good. You know, you basically get a discounted property for your first property, and then that gives you, things like that. There's lots of models the government needs to look at, because housing unaffordability is a huge problem on many levels. You can see homeless numbers, et cetera. So anything to do, especially our most important workers, you know, I think it's really important. But not just demand increasing things like, yeah, the no stamp duty thing, it's a massive kick for the market. Anyone who thinks that that's not going to push up prices more than 5% straight away is kidding themselves. It's not a great thing if you're a first-time buyer and want to buy in 3 years' time. You don't want this change to happen now. You want this change to happen either when you're doing it or not at all, because it'll just create a lot more demand in the market, push up prices further. So when you enter in 3 years' time, you pay a high price.
Yeah, and of course the scheme as announced is 10,000 or something. It's not a very large number of places, so it's not like it's going to move the dial that much.
But I
do think the point there is that, and in fact, the Productivity Commission report recently made a point. There's a lot of other models around the world that we haven't even thought about here in Australia, right? We've tended just to sort of first home buyer grants is it, right? And the Productivity Commission said actually that's not what you should be doing. Those just kick prices higher and actually don't help. So we have to be more creative, I think, in terms of actually some of the alternative schemes. But,
Yeah, we've just got a housing mismatch, right, of what we've built, what we've currently got versus what we need. And you know, and that's an issue that's not going to get solved overnight. You know, with material issues, you know, labor shortages in the construction sector. And you can't blame the developers. Developers have taken on risk for shareholders and, you know, to make a profit. And so you can't say that they shouldn't build X, Y, Z. You know, and so you just got to be careful. This thing's quite complicated and nothing can be solved. You know, more supply, if you say that's the answer, well, how much can we more can we build? We're already at capacity. How can we go and build, you know, another million houses, right? Mm. So there's lots of elements to solving this, and it's not going to happen overnight. This is a, if you wanted to solve this, it'd be a 20 or 30 year play.
Strategic.
Yeah. What's that?
Strategic.
Yeah, strategic. It would be, and it would be. You know, we're saying we're not going to try to win votes. And, you know, we're going to potentially make these changes over the next 10 years. We're not just going to go to an election and say, get rid of negative gearing. We're going to say, look, we don't think this is a good way sustainably. So we're going to shift this, phase this in over a period. Plus lots of other things. There's not just one ticket here. There's a combination of, you know, unlocking supply, reducing taxes, you know, a lot of, you know, NIMBYism, you know. There's lots of things that need to change to, if we want to keep growing our populations and, you know, if we unfortunately can't go and create another Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, you know, easily.
Very good. Well, we're running out of time, but there's another interesting, important question from Jason. And thanks for the super chat, Jason. What do you think about the current floods, both now and in the future? How will that impact the overall property market across Australia? It's actually a very important question, I think.
Look, the issue with this is insurance, really. And if you can't get insurance, then you can't get bank lending. If you can't get bank lending, then what's the property worth? Not much, right? And so if insurance companies start pulling out of properties because the flood risk is just too high, then they're uninsurable. And absolutely, that would smash those property values. So if you've got a property that is susceptible to some type of you know, climate change, sort of environmental sort of disaster, and insurance companies try to pull out, then I think you're taking a risk not worth taking. Insurance companies, you know, we need insurance companies to, you know, but if they keep losing money on natural disasters, then everyone's premiums go up. But who's to say that they just start making decisions and saying, we don't really want to play in these markets. And I think that's where the decision comes in. You could also see banks now saying, look, we need to see your building report or your building certificate of currency every year. I think that should be mandated. I mean, you have to insure your car, you need a green slip, right? Why don't you need to prove every year that you've got building insurance? But that's not the case. You could have and that's not protecting the bank or yourself, right? So, you know, you've got a $1 million house, you've got an $800,000 mortgage, your house burns down, you haven't got insurance. Well, you lose all your money, the bank loses money. That's just a big risk in the city, or it floods or whatever. So, I think people forget about things, you know, but if they're happening more regularly, you know, look at sort of the, you know, Western Sydney, look at places like Lismore, et cetera. How many till people really remember, right? And say, look, and if this thing, but yeah, it's a complicated one around climate change, isn't it?
It's huge. But what I always say to people is, have you looked at the flood maps? You know, look at the 100-year flood. Remember that we've had 300-year floods in 18 months, right? That just gives you a bit of a context. And quite often people haven't actually just done that basic check to make sure that they understand the risk, right? And then the other point is the insurance question is a really good one. Have you checked to see what the insurance cover on the property would be? If you can get insurance, how much would it cost? Or can you not get insurance? And it's interesting because agents actually aren't required to disclose that one way or the other. So you have to do your own due diligence on that as well. Those two things, I think, are quite helpful in terms of understanding what the potential risks are. But you've got to assume that sea level is going to rise. You're going to assume that we're going to get more bad weather. That means that more of the little creek behind the property could suddenly become a massive torrent. What happens when that, you know, when that does? So go around and look at with your eyes open in and around the area too. And look at the map. What's the height above sea level? You know, it's not rocket science, but a lot of people don't do that, Chris, in my experience, when they actually think about a property. They sort of see a property and, yeah, it's in the right sort of location and it's a nice and it looks nice and it's got very nice kitchen appliances. But
yeah,
there's a few other things to think about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think and a really wise thing. If you go buying a bog standard property in a suburb that's nowhere near where places are flooding and et cetera, right, then and it's like a terrace and everything's terraces, et cetera, then, you know, you might go, well, look, I'm not really worried about insurance, right? Mm. But it wouldn't hurt just to make a quick phone call, right?
Yep.
You can get a free, you know, quote, someone like Allianz, right? And they'll cover you till you settle on the property. And so you could call them up and say, look, I just want to cover this building for $1 million. Give them the address. They'll give you a rough quote, right? Yep. So if there's any issues with it. Why not do that as part of your due diligence? If there's potentially, if there's any risk. I mean, we upgraded, you know, 3-4 months ago. Our place backs onto a bush, you know, a national park. And absolutely, I wanted to know, what is this bowel, you know, fire zone? How's that going to affect insurance? Spoke to multiple insurance companies. And, you know, it was at the end of it, I was like, yeah, it's fine. It's not actually that much more. I'm confident that, you know, if something did happen there, we would still be able to get insurance. But I thought about it, right? And, you know, I got a quote on it. You know, a lot of people would go, might go, she'll be right, mate. And you know, that's it.
It is one of those things. It's the same, you know, fire as well, of course, as flood is important thing about in some areas too. Just important to do those basic, and you know, there's a bit of a checklist, right? And the checklist would include, well, inspect the property to make sure there's no structural issues, you know, understand what the risks are in terms of flooding and fire and those things. I mean, there's a bunch of things that just everybody should do. But unfortunately, I reckon less than half of the people that I speak with through my one-on-one conversations have actually done the journey, right? They've sort of jumped straight to that, I want to buy, right, without necessarily thinking it through. And the trouble is you've then got an ongoing liability that you may not realize that you've walked into.
Yeah, and insurance just isn't solve all your problems. You might get paid a bunch of cash. Is that enough? Like, the underinsurance problem is prolific in everything from life insurance to income protection to, you know, we'll insure our iPhone, but we won't insure our home, right? And, you know, that makes sense. It doesn't make sense. We also underinsure. Like, you know, if you try to, pretty much anyone who's probably looks at their building costs, you know, unless they've really thought about it diligently, would be completely underinsured if they had to build that house today. Yep. That replacement value would be, you know, way more. So, yeah, you've got insurance. Is it enough to rebuild what you had? Probably not. But you've got the stress. You've got the impact on family, you know, all these sort of things. You might have a fight because some reason with the insurance company. So, yeah, just insurance doesn't really save you. Maybe eases the pain, but it's not going to just all of a sudden magically rebuild your house.
No, that's a really good point. And of course, if you've got you know, a flood not once but two or three times, look at Lismore, for example, where there are people who just started to rebuild and then it's flooded again, and you know, that whole social psychological thing, that's more than just a question of insurance. That's a much more serious thing. So again, unfortunately, a property can become a huge liability if it's in the wrong place.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Well, Chris, we're coming close to the end of the show. Any last minute thoughts in terms of, you know, anybody thinking about buying at the moment? What's the number one thing they should have in their head at the moment?
Look, I think it's just really important to understand your position, what you're trying to achieve, like what's your income, where are you trying to buy, what's happening in that market? Like, switch off so much about the macro news. I mean, it's fun reading about it and this is what's happening, but how does that, and if you're worried about your property in your suburb, get to some auctions, get to some open homes, see if people are rocking up, you know. Don't just chat to agents, get on the ground. Like, you know, you can ease some of your worries, or maybe you can, you know, highlight some of your worries. But, you know, if you've got properties that are compromised, that are worried, you know, don't just assume they'll be okay. Like, don't just assume they're going to bounce back to what they were last year and, you know, you can get on with your life. So you just need to, you know, go in eyes wide open. And I think it's just really important that if you are buying, you need to know what is a good asset, you know, and know how to pick from it. And if you are waiting, you are looking, be super patient right now. You know that, yes, you'd like to buy and take advantage of the market, but the market doesn't deliver what you want. And that's the thing. So if you are patient and the property comes on, ticks all your boxes, it's a quality asset, and you can afford it, like, you've just got to think through, do you want to gamble that and try to buy something that potentially cheaper in the future? And that's hard to know whether you're actually going to get that opportunity. So, you could easily get to a point where you say, oh, you know what, that was the one that got away. I didn't actually go ahead for that. And I think that's what happened a lot in 2018, a lot happened in 2019, even early 20, where people just think, okay, that's all right, it'll replicate itself. But the good thing about quality assets, once you own them, is that they don't replicate themselves. No one really decides to sell. People are living in their homes longer, you know, for stamp duty, lots of other reasons. That would be my advice. Also, understand your strategy. Like, if you have got issues with borrowing capacity, you have got, okay, so how are things going to change? How would things change if your income went up? How would things change? Like, you need to be thinking, like you said, around scenarios, Martin. We do that all the time. You know, if you sell that, you could buy X. You just need to have a real clear strategy on how you're going to make calls on certain things, and just rest your mind at ease. Just make those calls rather than, just sort of thinking it's all too much.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for your time, as always, and your advice and your perspective. Always interesting speaking with you. You're probably more at the bullish end of the spectrum on property than I, but it is very interesting to get those different perspectives, which is what we try to do on the property, on the channel.
Not really, man. I would say, like, we've been coming on here since for 4 years.
Yeah.
Anyone can listen back to any episode. Yeah. And I've always spoke about danger zones.
Yeah.
High density, fringe suburbs, new property, etc. Busier roads, compromised property. This tune hasn't changed, right? And if you can, and you would see in those markets, like the places that didn't boom, or all the places, the danger zones, all that high density stuff is what didn't go up. So, you know, we're not bullish on the whole property market, but we're bullish on scarce assets that are actually even scarcer now in down markets.
Yep.
And they'll be the properties that bounce back, absolutely, because that's the people. When people confidence returns, people are not worried about rates, borrowing capacities increase, people go and buy the best assets. We live in a capitalist society, there's a portion, you even saw this data last yesterday, the number of people in the top tax rate has increased dramatically. Yeah, wage increases don't look like they're increases, but the number of people earning over higher incomes has increased, you know, I think it was like 18%. So the number of people out there that are on these incomes is increasing. Is there enough more properties on the market that they really want to be? No. If anything, there's less. And so, people sometimes forget that not everyone's in their position. And so the properties you'd want would be the ones that they want. And so that's where we're bullish. We're not bullish on everything else, which you sort of know about. Look forward to having a chat in the new year and see what actually happened. Did many listings come on? Did prices continue to fall? Did we start to see some stabilizing prices? Did we see open homes a bit busier? Did we see clearance rates start to jump? Like, you know, you could easily have that conversation in 3 months' time. And things aren't going to be as bad as people thought, you know, in October last year.
Well, Chris, we'll get you back on early next year and we'll be able to compare notes.
We'll do
then.
That.
If people want to find out more about you, where do they go?
Wealthful.com.au, wealth, and then FUL, F for Freddie.com.au. More than happy to see if we can help.
Terrific, Chris. Well, thanks very much for your time as always. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Martin.
I'll take you offline now and I'll close out the show. See ya.
Hopefully the dogs are still asleep, mate. See you later. Bye.
So there you go. Very interesting chat with Chris, as always, of course. And just before I close, just a couple of quick things to talk about. The first is just to remind you, there is tomorrow in Melbourne the Walk the World Nucleus Wealth and Macro Business event in the evening. The links are in the comments below. You can still register and go along if you want to. I'll be there, as will the macro business guys and Nucleus Wealth guys, and talking a little bit about what they're doing. So that's worth just highlighting. Secondly, just to say that next week, Damien Klassen's coming on to talk about where the markets are now. So you can join us for that. And that'll be an interesting conversation, given what the markets are currently doing. Are they going up, going down, going sideways? Who knows? And I will just give you a final view of the doggies. So the doggies are sound asleep. They've shuffled around a bit, but they haven't really gone very far all evening. So there you go. So thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening. Hope you enjoyed that. Thanks again to Chris. And I look forward to seeing you on the next show. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.